ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I just need to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a race happening on Wall Street as AI giants rush to go public and collect the prize of passive funds. Anthropic has made the latest move to file on the heels of SpaceX, which is already set to stage the largest public offering in stock market history. And a huge uptake in home batteries here in Australia is reshaping the power industry. Could battery-generated power help the nation to combat inflation? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm the ABC's Chief Business Correspondent, Ian Verinder.
Ian, so nice to see you. It's been 2 weeks away. In many ways, the world is exactly as I left it. There's still major disputes about when we're going to see the Strait of Hormuz opening. And there seems to be amazing optimism, particularly in the US, about the artificial intelligence revolution and how much profit these companies are going to be making. Is there anything I missed?
No, and the incredible amount of money they're going to be spending as well, which seems to be driving Wall Street's incredible drive to just buy more of them.
Yeah.
And they keep Wall Street just keeps hitting new records each day.
So we have woken up today to the news that Anthropic, this is the AI company behind the chatbot Claude. It was started by some kind of disaffected former employees of OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT. They've tried to market themselves as a more ethical artificial intelligence company, and that has actually put them into dispute with the Trump administration when it comes to how its tools are being deployed within the Pentagon, for example. But it now is on track to launch on the US stock market. Let's take a step back. First of all, this company is already managing to access huge amounts of money in order to fund its expansion. Why does it even need to bother to launch on the stock market?
Well, I mean, most companies get to a point where private funding becomes problematic. And so either you've got to have a very rich backer or, banks that are willing to lend you vast amounts of money. The money has to come from somewhere. And if you're not really generating the profits that you need to, and, bear in mind Anthropic is a relatively new company, the obvious way to go is to list on the stock exchange. We used to call it a float on the stock exchange back in the old days, but it's now called an IPO, an initial public offering. But it's a way to sell your company to the public and for them to provide cash for that company. Now, one of the, I guess, key questions in all of this is where does the money go? So a lot of the times you'll have an established private company that is a big money spinner and the founders just want to get out, and you've seen a big chemist in Australia float not so long ago, Chemist Warehouse. And that was essentially the owners there were trying to sell that operation to a major player for many years, couldn't get the price they wanted. They went to the public market and they sold that way. So it was a way for them to cash out, to take money off the table and walk away. So that's one
rationale.
Yeah, for doing it. The other one is that you need money to pour into the business.
Yeah.
And so you're getting investors from outside to pour money into the business rather than into your own pocket.
Sometimes I remember with Elon Musk, there was a period where he was kept suggesting he was going to take Tesla private again because he seemed to be irritated by all the scrutiny that you receive as a public company. This is kind of one of the drawbacks of actually being listed, is that there's supposed to be stricter rules on the way that these companies operate. But usually, well, at least the companies decide to go public, the reason they do it is because they can get better access to money, particularly at a time when we have so much passive investment and when you're on that index, you get a huge amount of investment in your company just because of your size. And these companies are going to be immediately massive players on the stock market. So we've got a situation now in 2026 with three potentially $1 trillion plus launches on the US stock market. SpaceX is expected to go public this month. This is the Elon Musk backed enterprise. The SpaceX refers to its space exploration, but that's only one part of the business. That part is linked directly to his satellite system that allows high-speed internet, Starlink, which is actually where most of the profit is currently coming from. But they're really trying to market this as an AI play as well. He's got Grok attached to X, what was formerly known as Twitter. I mean, it's a complicated mess of a company.
Yeah.
But Elon Musk is definitely trying to argue that this is one of the direct competitors with OpenAI, with Anthropic, and is vying to be one of the major players to control the transformation into our AI. It'll be launching in the next couple of weeks, it looks like. Is there a race going on to get there? And why might there be a race between these big three players to be the first to get to market?
Well, if you're the first to get to market, you've got you're the first one to take the money. And look, there's an important distinction here. When you float on the stock exchange or you launch your IPO, the money comes in. Now, you know, let's say they raise $1 trillion and then the share price goes up. But when the share price goes up, that's not extra money flowing into the company directly. That's the people who own it, the shareholders who own it. That's the value of their shares rising. And when the value of the shares rise, it obviously makes it easier for the company to raise cash elsewhere, either from banks or from lenders, wherever. But the initial public offering itself is where the grub stake comes from. So that $1 trillion goes into the company. It goes into investment, into the founders' pockets, wherever it goes. And then after that, once the share price rises, because the company is more valuable, it makes it easier to raise debt. And, you know, because you're, you know, if you have a debt to equity ratio often. So if your company's worth, say, $1 trillion and then the value of it goes to $2 trillion, you can raise a lot more debt elsewhere.
And so at the moment when we've been talking about the valuations of these privately held companies, it's been based on the different funding rounds they've gone through, which is given that they say they've raised a certain amount of money at X valuation.
Yeah.
It's less transparent than once you're on the stock market where you can very clearly see how much is a share worth, how many shares are held by individuals, and therefore what is the value of this enterprise.
Yeah, look, there's a bit of a thimble and pea trick with private companies who raise cash like that. What they'll say is, you know, they'll raise, say, say $10 million and, you know, and sell 10 million shares for that. And then in the next raising, they'll raise another $10 million, but for 5 million shares. And then they'll say, well, the value of our shares has doubled, right? And so, and then this is the way a lot of private companies, and there's a couple of big Australian companies that have been doing this as well. Canva is one of them. So their valuation is based on an internal kind of round robin raising of cash, and they just determine what the price is and then say, well, because of, you know, this is what we've raised this small amount of capital at, that then translates into the company being worth vast amounts of money. It's only when you really list on the public markets where you've got large volumes of shares available to be bought and sold where you can get an accurate estimation of what the company's worth.
Now, at the moment, there seems to be nothing but optimism when it comes to the business models of these companies. Remember, there were some shakes at the start of the year. There'd previously been some shakes when it came to the CrowdStrike, the sell-off that we saw in AI, where suddenly people started to worry about valuations. They all seem to have subsided for the moment. And it appears that if your company is linked to AI, you're basically seen as backing a winner. How do you feel when you look at the valuations we're seeing on the stock market and the risk of there being some problems down the path? I mean, you've been watching markets for a very long time. Does this remind you of any other type of boom that we've seen in the past?
Well, I mean, you've only got to hark back to the tech wreck or the tech boom of 2000. The difference this time around, though, is that it's been driven, at least in the initial phases, by a company's very big and very profitable companies like Microsoft and Google and so forth. And they've been funding their development out of cash flow, so out of profits. Whereas back then during the dot-com boom, you had a whole lot of companies essentially listing on the stock market, raising cash, burning through that cash, then raising more and more and more, all on the promise that they were going to make vast profits down the track. Now, this again is all based on making huge amounts of money out of AI down the track. And the valuations are essentially baked in that we're going to make a lot of money here, but not everyone is going to be a winner in this race. And that's something that I think everybody needs to be wary of. If you're putting your money into a company that has a huge cash generation engine there in the background that's partially funding this, you're probably on safer ground than going directly into an organisation that really doesn't earn a lot of money at the moment, but is just all promising blue sky down the track.
So we've been talking in the last few years about the Magnificent Seven. These are the big mega cap companies that have driven so much of the growth in the stock market. I guess if we add these three that are expected to launch this year, we've got some sort of 10. I can't. What's our adjective for the 10? We'll work on that by the end of this program. but it is so concentrated where we've seen this growth recently. And also the mingling of them is also quite extraordinary. And I was looking at the update from Anthropic in its most recent funding round, where it was talking about the different companies it was paying, including Alphabet and other companies in that Magnificent Seven. There is so much cross-pollination within this industry at the moment. Does that lower the risk or heighten the risk of this all coming a cropper?
It really, I think, heightens the risk because, you know, you've got, as you say, cross-pollination. You've got one company agreeing to spend a vast amount of money on another company's engineering or chips, or in exchange for that company then taking the services from the it's really, you know, interlinked in such a complex way. And really just think back to, I guess, the global financial crisis, where you had financial institutions that were incredibly interlinked with their lending and their, you know, the money transfers between them. And of course, when things started to turn pear-shaped, nobody quite knew exactly how exposed one bank was to another bank. And so as a result, everybody just were headed for the hills and wouldn't invest in banks. Banks wouldn't lend to one another because they didn't know how exposed other institutions were to this, you know, property market collapse in America. So when you do have such a tightly interlinked model such as this, things can go wrong. And I mean, you know, when you talk about the concentration, that is a real worry at the moment.
The expression "too big to fail" immediately comes to mind. Right, we talk about this when it comes to the big banking institutions. That eventually, the government's basically said that these institutions are so massive, but also so critically important to the economy that they had to get in there to support them, because if they allowed them to collapse, which is supposed to be a usual part of the capitalist process, right? If you bet the wrong way and your company isn't profitable, you're supposed to fall away and then a new company can sprout up. But what could be worrying about these mega caps, the Magnificent Seven, we'll work out our name for the 10, is that they are so important that everyone needs them to succeed. We've got the NASDAQ actually looking at loosening the rules to allow them to launch because they want them on their stock market. But also individual countries are looking at relaxing their rules to incentivize them to come to set up in their own country, including here in Australia, where Anthropic wants rules changed when it comes to copyright so that it can train its models. And the carrot for the Australian government is, well, if you do this, then we'll invest huge amounts of money. And this allows you to not only reap the economic rewards from that investment, but also it means you can have people working for this company that's going to be at the forefront of this revolution.
Yeah. I mean, just from an investment point of view, though, as well, all Australians have got money invested in these companies through your superannuation funds. And superannuation funds tend to try and spread the money as far and as widely as possible. The problem is, you invest on Wall Street and you invest in say, somewhere in Asia, you're investing only in a handful of companies because these companies now dominate Wall Street to such an extent that when you put your money into Wall Street, because a lot of the trading is now computerized, in fact, it's artificial intelligence that's running your investments. You know, there's what's known as exchange-traded funds, and it's all essentially run by a computer. So in Australia, for instance, if you don't know what to invest in, you can just buy a unit in these exchange-traded funds, and you just get access to Australian Stock Exchange. But what you do is your money is invested into the biggest companies, starting with the biggest and going down the list down to the 200th biggest company. So your money will be in the Commonwealth Bank and BHP overwhelmingly, and then it goes down the list. If you translate that over to America, you've got basically all your money, right, that you've invested on Wall Street locked up in a handful of companies.
Yep.
You go to Korea, all locked up in a handful of companies. Go, you know, Taiwan, a couple of chip makers. So everything is becoming incredibly concentrated. And the danger there is that if this AI investment boom unwinds, then everybody is going to feel the pain.
One of the other things that these companies need, besides cash, is huge amounts of electricity.
Yeah.
You did an article this week talking about how batteries have transformed the electricity market here in Australia for the better, in that they have actually led to lower prices when it comes to what people are paying at home, but also what businesses are paying. Take us through how transformative the subsidy from the government for batteries has been, and has it finally proven whether or not renewables can be cheaper to fossil fuels when it comes to generating electricity?
Well, there's no doubt that renewables are much cheaper than fossil fuels. I mean, your fuel is free; it comes from the sun. Whereas a coal-fired generator, you've got to build this massive steam engine. Essentially, you've got to dig up the coal, you've got to burn it through. There's a cost that isn't calculated, which is the cost of the damage to the environment. Whereas with renewables, a lot of those costs are not, you know, just not there. You know, it's much cheaper to build solar farms than it is to build a coal generator, and much, much cheaper than nuclear power. So there's no doubt that it's cheaper. But what's happened, I guess, in Australia, is we're in a very unique position here. We're kind of at ground zero in this whole ideological battle over climate change and electricity generation, because Australians have taken to solar power like no other country in the world. Now, you know, something like one in four households, around about 4 million households, have solar panels on the roof. And until pretty much, well, the numbers I saw dated to July last year, very few Australian households had batteries, because for a long time the numbers just didn't really stack up. You're going to spend all this money on a battery. How long is it going to take you to recoup the cost? It's too expensive. So the government's idea to put this 30% subsidy on batteries happened to coincide with a dramatic collapse in the price of batteries as well. So battery prices have actually dropped by 99% since the 1990s. So the price is still falling because of scale. They're all being made in China, and because there's being less mineral input used. Right. They're becoming more efficient in the way they use the minerals to actually make the batteries. So the price of batteries is falling, and as a result, we've seen an overwhelming response from Australian households to install these batteries. And that's had a huge impact on the way electricity is not just generated here, but distributed through the system. And so, you know, one of the big problems we've had with solar power, rooftop solar power, is that in the middle of the day, you get this enormous amount of electricity flooding back into the grid, which then would crash the price of electricity, sometimes to below zero, which would then make the coal-fired generators, which can't just switch off, you know, they're operating at a loss. And then at nighttime, there'd be a shortage of power. And the way that we got around that was to have gas basically coming into the system with gas-fired generators.
And we talked about gas being this important transitional system as we moved from existing fossil fuel, big coal-powered plants to renewables. And the story had been, up until quite recently, that this would be a prolonged period of gas being critical to that transition, which doesn't seem to be playing out.
The reason gas is so critical is because you can press a button and it goes on. You can press a button and it goes off. It is immediate. Unlike coal, which can't be turned on or off. Yep. You know, it takes months to do both of those processes. So gas filled that breach. You know, if you get a sudden drop off in power at nighttime, you press the gas generator, on it goes, problem solved. What's been happening, though, now in the past 12 months is that the sudden increase in the amount of battery space we've got, both grid scale and household batteries, means that households are storing the energy rather than sending it back into the system during the day. You can now have what's known as a virtual power plant in your home. You hook up with a provider, and they will sell power into the system when prices are very high. And that's generally at nighttime when you don't have a lot of renewable generation. So we're evening out the whole, distribution. So instead of it all going into the system in one hit, it's going out over the course of the 24 hours. And AEMO, which is the Australian Energy Market Operator, put out a report a few weeks ago, which basically showed that gas no longer is the price setter for electricity. And why is that important? Because gas has been extraordinarily expensive because we've had a couple of big export companies essentially denuding the local market of supply. And so gas prices here have been hugely expensive. And because it's that final stage, it's that emergency kick-in.
Yeah, the marginal operator.
That's right. It's the marginal operator. It sets the price. So when the price of gas went up, the price of electricity soared, as we saw after the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And that soaring electricity prices really drove a lot of the inflation problem that we had. And so what we're seeing now is that gas is no longer the price setter. Batteries, for the first time, have become the price setter.
Which is an extraordinary shift in the way we interact with the electricity market. And it could have major impacts on how inflation goes from here, because it is the most volatile item. Well, fuel, petrol prices, as we've seen because of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, but also it has in the past fed into electricity prices.
Yeah.
Because it's not just gas as well, right? It's also diesel is important for moving around coal around the country for these power stations. So the more you're reliant on renewable energy and batteries, the less you're reliant on importing fuel or the international gas price, which could mean lower inflation. Lower inflation could in turn mean lower interest rates.
If you look at the inflation numbers from the most recent ones that for April, in the past 12 months, the 12 months leading up to April, electricity prices were up 23%, I think. 23%. That is a huge increase for such a primary need for every Australian household. So what we've seen since then is that the price of electricity has now been, well, there's a benchmark price that's formulated for certain parts of the country, going to be dropping around about 10%.
And I think part of the reason we had that big spike with electricity prices was because it was a rolling off of the government rebates.
That's true.
Which had disrupted the market, but it's still the most volatile item. And the more you can control the supply of electricity here in Australia, it's not reliant on what's happening globally, the more stable you would think inflation would be. And that will be critical for the Reserve Bank because it will mean that they can get interest rates lower, which most people will welcome.
Well, I mean, it's really been quite extraordinary that Australia, which is really an energy powerhouse, you know, we're the world's biggest supplier of coal, seaborne coal. We're one of the world's biggest suppliers of LNG. And yet our electricity prices have been extraordinarily high.
Yeah.
And that's because we're hooked into a global export market for energy. So if you now basically can just produce energy on your own, and a lot of households, I think, have flocked to the battery program primarily because they've been sick and tired of seeing their energy bills come in at such extraordinary levels and huge price rises each time.
And Australia is very lucky in that we are blessed with huge amounts of sunlight. Now, sometimes that can be a problem when we have drought conditions, but overall, it's a very good position to be. There's lots of places in Northern Europe who would love to have the access to sunlight that we have. Mm-hmm. They just can't do rooftop solar in the same way. It also strikes me when I was in America, when you would fly over places, including in Arizona or in places where you would expect there to be huge amounts of solar arrays, there just wasn't.
Right.
Australia really does stand out that you have solar panels over most places where it makes sense to have them.
Yeah, I know.
And I think Australians have become used to kind of having the ability to invest in their own electricity generation. And so now that they've seen batteries working for their neighbours, they're hearing that it's working for other people, you've seen this exponential take up of batteries. And I think once people have had them, they're going to stick with it because they like the control it gives them and they like the fact that they're not reliant on whatever the given price is for buying electricity off the grid.
I mean, even though, you know, climate change has been such a political hot potato, some of the most vocal critics of climate change and the science of climate change have solar on their roof. You know, it's just extraordinary. But another interesting thing here is too that the demand for batteries, 60% of global demand for batteries right now outside of China, if you eliminate China, guess where it's coming from? Australia.
This number is crazy to me. Yeah. Is it really because of the subsidy program? Is it because of the fact that we have individual, we have such high penetration of solar on people's homes that people, there's a reason to have that. It's the connection between the two things, isn't it?
Well, you know, as I said, only 8% of solar connected homes had batteries until a year ago. Now, suddenly you've got another 400,000 households that have hooked into batteries. And yes, it's because we've got such a, you know, a huge network of solar connected homes. It's clear that with the price drop and with the government subsidy there, that was pretty much a no-brainer for a lot of households.
So it does raise a question, though. So it appears we've finally got electricity prices starting to come down because of the investment in batteries. But you now have these AI companies who are hungry for huge amounts of electricity.
Yeah.
They say that they want to come here to invest in Australia if we can change some of the conditions, for example, of copyright. But anyway, if we do see that, is the risk that we would see a spike in electricity prices once again because you have these companies wanting to draw down on the grid?
I would say so. Yeah, we're going to have to, you know, do something about ensuring that anyone who wants to build data centres here has sourced electricity before they start.
Building their own power plants. That's right. Investing in renewables. Yeah.
Yep. Or, you know, building grid-scale power, you know, grid-scale renewables.
Fascinating. And you can read Ian's article on the ABC website. That's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. But before we go, a quick note. Australia's Fair Work Commission has announced that the minimum wage will increase from July the 1st of this year. Now, this decision is part of the FWC's annual wage review, and we'll be back with another episode tomorrow to dig into what it means for workers and the economy across Australia. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to send in a question, you can email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. For me, for Ian, or for any of the other co-hosts on our program. Catch you next time, Ian.
See ya.